Well, we're making another stop tonight on Route 66, our journey through the Bible, in which we're overviewing each of the 66 books over the course of a couple of years. This is our second Route 66 message in 2 weeks. We're going to take a little time off before the next one. A couple of weeks from now, David is going to lead us in a study of Esther. And then after Esther, we're going to jump to the New Testament and work through the Gospels before coming back to the Old Testament and working through the poetry books, Job through Song of Solomon. So tonight, we are going to spend our time in Ezra and Nehemiah, the last of the historical books of the Old Testament, or rather, next to last of the historical books of the Old Testament. We've traveled far in our journey from Genesis through Chronicles, and we've seen the broad landscape of Old Testament history flash before our eyes. We observed in the first week that we're going to be capturing the big picture. So what have we seen so far? We've seen a powerful Creator God form and fill the heavens and the earth, breathe life into all that lives, and see that everything is good. We've seen a personal God relate intimately to His creation, especially humankind. We've seen humankind reject God and come to know evil, death, and the erosion of the good world. We have seen a gracious God initiate a plan to redeem humankind from evil and death and to restore the goodness of the world through a man named Abraham. We've seen God establish a covenant relationship with Abraham and promise to make his family a great nation, to give them a good land, and to bless the entire world through them. We've seen God's providence in executing his plan of redemption and his faithfulness to his promises to Abraham. We've seen God deliver Abraham's descendants, the Israelites, from slavery in Egypt. We've seen God give the Israelites a national and spiritual identity, institute a new covenant of blessings and curses with them, give them a law to guide them, a system of worship to purify them, prophets to instruct and exhort them, and kings to rule over them. And we've seen the Israelites respond to God's providence and faithfulness with rejection and rebellion. We've seen them violate God's law and worship other gods. We've seen the Israelites mistreat and kill God's prophets and its leaders do what is evil in the sight of God. In response to the Israelites' unfaithfulness to God, we have seen God execute the terms of the covenant, allowing the Israelites to be raided by foreign nations and suffer drought, famine, and disease. We've seen God split the kingdom of Israel in half and finally allow his people to be exiled from the promised land. Last week, we stopped on Route 66 at Chronicles, which focuses on the best of Israel during the period of the kings, giving hope to the exiles living outside the promised land that God was active in forging for them a new future, just as he had been active in shaping their past with his providence and faithfulness to his promises. The final few pages of Chronicles detail the decline and exile of Judah, and yet the book ends anticipating a new beginning. This is 2 Chronicles 36:22. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. So Chronicles ends with the anticipation that the Israelites would go up geographically, back up to Jerusalem. And then Ezra Nehemiah resumes where Chronicles finishes. In fact, you'll notice that the first 2.5 verses of Ezra are identical to the final 2 verses of Chronicles. They're exactly what we just read. Ezra Nehemiah features the carrying out of the decrees of Cyrus and other Persian officials, which authorized the return of the exiles to the Promised Land, the restoration of Judaism, and the restoration of Jerusalem. So I want us to look first at some of the features of Ezra and Nehemiah before talking about the contents. So here's some of the features. Ezra Nehemiah has gone by different names and has been found in different forms in various editions of the Old Testament. At one time, Ezra Nehemiah was one book and was simply called Ezra. Have you seen this as a recurring theme in the historical books of the Old Testament? Many of them, which are divided in our English Bibles, were once one. So Ezra Nehemiah was once one and was called Ezra. It has, at times, gone by 1st and 2nd Ezra when it was divided. There is a tradition that suggests Ezra Nehemiah was once part of Chronicles. And so the four books, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, and then Nehemiah, were all one, and they were written to trace Israel's history from Adam all the way through the return of the exiles to the Promised Land. Now, that tradition is not really well supported by the evidence, but it does acknowledge the close relationship between Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. They share a lot of similar themes, a lot of similar language in those books. We don't know for sure who wrote Ezra, Nehemiah. A popular Jewish tradition is that Ezra wrote both Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles, but even those who suggest that theory acknowledge that there was some later editing and the book was compiled over a period of time a little bit later. The book was most likely finished no more than just a few decades after the events at the end of Nehemiah. Ezra Nehemiah can be a little confusing on first read. It contains lists of names and numbers, like Chronicles. The chronology is a little bit jumbled. In fact, if you're reading through Ezra and you know much about world history, you come to Ezra chapter 4 and suddenly we're jumping from one Persian king to the next. And we think, what's going on here? What's the deal with the chronology? So it's a little bit jumbled up. Several times the narrator switches and it's very abrupt from the first to the third person. So you see the author saying, I was doing this, and then they were doing this. And so the switches are quite abrupt, and it can make it difficult for the reader to keep up. Most of the difficulties of Ezra and Nehemiah can be overcome when we acknowledge a few realities. And a couple of them we've acknowledged throughout our study of the historical books of the Old Testament. The first is that, like all Old Testament history and all history in general, Ezra and Nehemiah is selective. It includes a sample of the events of the Promised Land, or the events of the return to the Promised Land, rather, over a period of about a century. There's about 50 years between Ezra 1 to 6 and chapter 7, and then the events of the rest of the book of Ezra and Nehemiah take place over many years. So the purpose of this book is not to give a detailed accounting of everything that happened to the Jews over that 100-year period. It's just a sampling of some of the things that took place. Also, like all Old Testament history and all history in general, Ezra Nehemiah is subjective. The author did not sit down to write a perfectly ordered, objective history of the return from exile. In fact, that would be impossible to do even if he tried. He wrote for a number of specific reasons. He wrote to legitimize the return of the exiles from a legal standpoint. That's why there's so much legal material in Ezra and Nehemiah. And then he wrote from a covenantal perspective. So the author intended that the history of the return from exile be viewed through a religious lens. So we're wanting to see this as God, or we're supposed to see this, as God would have us see this history. And then some of the confusion that might be seen on the first read can be cleared up when we note that there are several sources that kind of come together as part of this particular book. There are royal decrees and letters, legal censuses and lists, and then there are the memoirs of Ezra and Nehemiah. Those are the first person sections. So when you come across I, you're getting the journals of Ezra and Nehemiah there. So these various sources are combined to give the reader a broad, big picture view of the return from exile. So if we get too concerned about a seeming lack of chronology and too concerned about the lists, we're going to miss the big picture. The big picture is legitimize the return from exile legally and covenantally. Chronologically, as I noted at the beginning, Ezra Nehemiah is the end of the Old Testament. After the events of Ezra Nehemiah, the biblical record skips about 400 years. And so the next books, chronologically, are the Gospels of Jesus. So there's 400 years that the Bible doesn't tell us anything about. That particular gap is often called the intertestamental period, between the Testaments, Old and New Testament. We haven't talked a lot about international events during our Route 66 series, but it's during the intertestamental period that Alexander the Great lived and that the Roman Empire rose to power. On a strictly Jewish level, it's during these 400 years that the Pharisee and Sadducee parties took shape. You don't see anything about them in the Old Testament, and then suddenly they're prominent in the Gospels. It's during the 400 years that the synagogue system developed, and it's during that 400 years that the communities that were anticipating the coming of the Messiah, like the Qumran community, which gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls, originated. So there's a large portion of history that's missing from the biblical record. We just need to acknowledge that. Before we get to the outline and story, one other interesting feature of Ezra and Nehemiah, and that is that portions of it are written in Aramaic. So most of us understand the fact that the New Testament was written largely in Greek, with a few words of Aramaic and phrases of Aramaic scattered throughout. And the Old Testament was written almost entirely in Hebrew. But there are a couple of sections of Aramaic in the Old Testament. There's a fairly large chunk in the book of Daniel, and then there's a fairly large chunk here in Ezra. Ezra chapter 4, verse 8 through 6, verse 18, and 7, 12 to 26 are in Aramaic. So what's the point of all of that? I only bring that up to say to you that the Aramaic language during the time of the exile and post-exile was the international language of trade and diplomacy. So we likely see these sections of Aramaic in Ezra to, as I've already pointed out, legitimize the return from exile legally. So these are legal documents that are being included in this biblical book. Legal documents straight from the annals of the Persian Empire. All right, let's spend a little time with the details of this book, and I'm throwing up on the screen an outline. This is just a simple working outline. Ezra and Nehemiah could be outlined in a lot of different ways, so I've chosen to do it this way. Ezra 1 and 2, the first return from exile. Ezra 3 to 6, the temple rebuilt. Ezra 7 and 8, the second return from exile. Ezra 9 and 10, there's a reformation movement. Nehemiah 1 and 2 is a third return, which is basically Nehemiah and a few others. Nehemiah 3 to 7, the wall is rebuilt. Nehemiah 8 to 10, there's a covenant renewal. And then 13 or 11 to 13 is another reformation movement. So Ezra and Nehemiah can seem a little bit disjointed at first glance, but there's a real symmetry to the book. Look at this. And I learned from David Holder how to use alliteration. So these are all R. You got return, rebuild, return, reform, return, rebuild, renew, reform. So there's a real symmetry to the way Ezra and then Nehemiah is laid out. And this is just incidental. It just happened this way, or maybe someone did it on purpose. But anyway, in chapter 9 of each of the two books is a long prayer of confession. So that's just an interesting little detail. We're not going to detail the entire story, but let's just break it down a little bit, and then we'll get to our crucial questions and talk about some of the main things to look for. Ezra Nehemiah opens with that decree of Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia, authorizing the exiled Israelites to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. World history tells us that less than a year before Cyrus gave this declaration, this decree, he defeated the Babylonians. You'll remember it's the Babylonians who actually took the southern tribes out of the land, and then it's the Persians who are going to send them back. And so it's just a few months before the decree of Cyrus that Persia comes in and defeats Babylon. Now, none of us have ever been emperors of empires, so a little bit about running an empire. Running an empire is difficult, especially if you have a really large, really powerful empire, because you rule over many different lands with different people who have different histories and approaches to life and religious practices. So the Persian rulers sought to establish allegiance from these disparate peoples through goodwill. So when Cyrus defeated Babylon, he made decrees to all of the various peoples throughout throughout the old Babylonian Empire. And his decrees looked like this. He started out by talking about how much better he was than the Babylonian kings. And then he went on to say that their lives are going to be much better now that he is king and not the Babylonians. And then the third item in these decrees was always to encourage the various peoples to rebuild their temples and their religious centers that the Babylonians always destroyed whenever they came into new places. And then Cyrus would give royal grants to fund these projects. And then it would end by Cyrus telling the people, when you've got all of this restored and you've rebuilt your temple and all of that, then pray to your gods for me. So Cyrus was a brilliant politician. He was viewed as a liberator by many of the peoples of the ancient Near East. And furthermore, he hedged his bets, so to speak. If he had all the different peoples praying to their gods on his behalf, some of them might be false, some of them might be real. And so he was going to make sure that he was prayed to, he was prayed about to the real gods. On the screen behind me is a picture of what's known as the Cyrus Cylinder, and it's currently housed in the British Museum. I saw this last summer, and on this little scroll, this cylinder, it's a baked clay, is an inscription of a decree made by Cyrus in the 530s, which is exactly the time that the decree that's recorded in Ezra chapter 1 was issued. And it follows the exact same pattern. Talk about how great Cyrus is, and then how good the lives of the people are going to be, and then he tells the Mesopotamians, go out and rebuild your temples. So this was the common political practice of the first Persian kings. And so God, Ezra chapter 1 verse 1 states, worked through Cyrus and worked through this political process. He stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the text says, to liberate his people. The timing, which was 70 years, and the name of the liberator, Cyrus, had been predicted by the prophets Jeremiah and Isaiah, who witnessed the exile to the Assyrians and Babylonians, respectively. Ezra 1 and 2 records the first return to the promised land following the exile. Though there are two exiles in the Old Testament, there's the exile of the north and there's the exile of the south. It's the southern exile that's the major one, and that's the focus of Ezra and Nehemiah. Anytime they talk about the exile, that's the one that they're talking about. That's the one Jeremiah witnessed, and that's the one he said, after 70 years, you'll come back. Have you ever wondered why 70 years? Why not 50? Why not 100? The answer is found in 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20 and 21. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until, here it is, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. According to the law of Moses, the children of Israel were required to give the land a Sabbath every 7 years. And the children of Israel never did in all the time they lived in the promised land. And so God finally said to them, if you're not going to give the land a rest, I will. And so he brought them out of the land, and he gave the land 70 Sabbaths, one for every one that the Israelites had neglected to give the land. It was exactly 490 years that the Israelites had lived in the land and had missed these Sabbath rests. So a little interesting trivia there. The first return was led by two men, Zerubbabel, who was the grandson of Jehoiakim, who was the final king of Judah, and then Jeshua, the grandson of the final high priest of the first temple. So we're two generations removed from the fall, and we've got the grandsons of the two main leaders actually leading the first wave of people back into Jerusalem. And incidentally, it's the grandson of Jeshua, who is later another leader in a future Reformation movement. Significantly, Zerubbabel never tries to reinstitute the monarchy. He's the rightful heir to the throne, but he never tries to reinstitute that. The focus of this first return is to restore the temple, just as the decree of Cyrus had stated. And so that aim is reflected in the number of priests, Levites, temple servants, and singers who returned. If you look in that list there in Ezra 2, you're going to see all of these temple personnel listed there. Shortly after their return, Jeshua and the priests rebuilt the altar of God and burnt offerings to the Lord. That's in chapter 3. That's exactly what Abraham did when he first came to the Promised Land. He immediately built an altar. In fact, he built several of them throughout the Promised Land and offered up sacrifices to God. After the altar was restored, the people celebrated the Feast of Booths, which was their harvest festival. So it was a symbol of God's renewal for the Israelites. The harvest festival celebrated renewal, and so the people immediately celebrate that. They're being renewed to their old land. And then the people began to make preparations for rebuilding the temple. That temple project proved to be a long and arduous process, and it's recorded in chapters 4 to 6. The Israelites were opposed by local officials and other peoples of the land, and then a diplomatic battle ensued, and we have the records of the letters that are sent back and forth from the local officials to the king of Persia, and all that's recorded in chapters 4 to 6. So it took several years for the temple to be completed once it was started. After that, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread was celebrated. Zerubbabel was probably dead at the time the temple was completed, and so we see new leaders finishing up the temple. And this is interesting because they have books in the Bible that bear their name. Haggai and Zechariah are the ones that finish up the temple. So there's the context for those books that we'll cover on Route 66 a little bit later. The second return was led by Ezra several decades after the temple was rebuilt. Ezra returned with the authorization of a new Persian king, Artaxerxes. So there was Cyrus for the first one and then Artaxerxes for this one. And Ezra was given a whole lot of authority. Ezra's mission was a little bit different. The first mission was go back and restore the temple. Ezra came with the authority to restore the religious structure of Israel, to call the people back to obedience to the law of Moses, and then to free the Levites from paying taxes. So this was intended to give the Levites full focus on temple worship. They had the temple rebuilt, but they needed to be able to focus, and they couldn't while they were having to pay taxes, get jobs, and so forth. Ezra 8 records that second return. Notice how few come, 1,800 approximately. There were 50,000 the first time, and only 1,800 the second time. In fact, so few are willing to come that Ezra has to go out and recruit Levites to come back to the promised land. So why were so few willing to go? Nobody was forced. Cyrus said, whoever wants to go back, go back. And Ezra was very similar. Whoever wants to go back, go back. Why so few? Well, many of the Jews had become quite successful living outside the promised land. They had opportunities for business interaction, and many of them had started very successful businesses, and they didn't want to go back. They didn't want to give up their homes and their livelihoods. They couldn't care less about what was going on in Jerusalem any longer. And how sad is that? The land God wanted them to have is their inheritance. They didn't even want to go back to. Ezra's return is filled with prayer, fasting, and reliance on God. Upon returning to Jerusalem, Ezra discovered that some of the Israelites had intermarried with the pagans. Now, this wasn't anything new, but this is likely, almost certainly, of the ones who had initially returned just a few decades before, that they've already gone back into intermarrying with pagans. And so Ezra is deeply distraught upon learning this. And in fact, he tears out his hair and his beard and his clothes. And according to chapter 9, verses 3 to 15, he sits down in a public square outside the temple with his clothes all ripped and his beard and hair all torn apart. And he just sits there and offers a prayer of confession to God. And then 3 days later, the Israelites are gathered outside the temple in the rain, confessing their sins. And then all of those who married the foreign women were forced to divorce them. And then a blacklist was created, and we have it recorded for us in chapter 10. So it's a really harrowing scene, and indeed it's a real drastic measure, but it emphasizes the seriousness of sin. It's quite shocking to us as modern readers to think that Ezra would require this, that all of these people who had married and had children would be forced to divorce. But that just emphasizes that sin is not something that can be messed around with. A couple of clarifications are needed about this scene. First, the divorce is required because of a specific violation, intermarrying with the pagans. And that was explicitly condemned, but it had been at the heart of the Israelite apostasy since Solomon. The divorce isn't required because God is a racist. You know, a lot of people want to levy that charge against God. He wouldn't let them marry outside the outside Jew. Well, he did allow that in certain cases. The problem here was that he didn't want them to be corrupted. He didn't want their spirituality to be corrupted by these foreign people. I think I have sometimes had the sense that after this scene, the whole social structure was just devastated and there was nothing but divorced women and children without fathers running around Judea and no one was feeding them. That's not how this went down at all. The fact is, less than 1%, in fact, less than 0.5% of the people had actually committed this particular sin. So it was a very small number. It's still a serious sin, but very few were directly affected. And then after Ezra, there is Nehemiah. And I'll say just a couple of words about the difference between the two men in a second. But Ezra and Nehemiah had similar goals, but they did have different emphases as leaders. Nehemiah's specific goal was to rebuild Jerusalem, according to chapter 1. The Israelites populate it. The temple's been rebuilt. Ezra's reforming the people. Nehemiah wants to go back and rebuild the city. And so he receives authorization from Artaxerxes, according to chapter 2. Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer, and evidently the king thought quite highly of Nehemiah. And so he gave him a great deal of authority and gave him blessing. In fact, sent him with guards and a whole procession all the way to Jerusalem. Nehemiah returned secretly because he knew that his work would be opposed by the local officials and by the other peoples of the land. Why did he know that? Well, probably he knew what had happened to Zerubbabel and to Jeshua many years before. Nehemiah met significant challenges as he anticipated. The Jews were mocked, according to chapter 2, verse 19. They received angry threats, verse 1 of chapter 4. And they were conspired against. But the text says, this is a famous verse of Nehemiah, chapter 4, verse 6, the people had a mind to work, and it only took 52 days for the wall to be built. And then they dedicated it to God. The rebuilding of the wall was significant, but that's not really the focus of the book of Nehemiah. It's not as much on the wall as it is on Nehemiah and Ezra's reforms, societal reforms and religious reforms. Before the wall was completed, Nehemiah sought to restore social justice. Chapter 5 gives us this story about how the rich were oppressing the poor by exacting interest for loans and so forth, and were making them slaves. And Nehemiah said, "Why are you doing this to your own people? Quit doing that." And in fact, he confessed that he himself was guilty of that particular sin. He said, "What we need here is solidarity and oneness. And so quit doing that to your people." And they all agreed. And then Nehemiah became a real example to the people. After he returned to Jerusalem, Artaxerxes appointed him governor. And for 12 years, he served as governor. As governor, he was given an allotment of food, and it was a lot for him and his staff. But he refused to take any of the payment that the emperor gave him because he wanted there to be equality among him and the people. Nehemiah made a number of other reforms. He dealt with intermarriage like Ezra. He organized and reformed the temple worship and more. He even cleansed the temple, which foreshadows what Jesus did many years before. Ezra went and drove people out of the temple that were doing things that were wrong. The most significant scene in Nehemiah is in chapters 8 to 10. And this is critical to understanding the mentality of the leaders and the people during the return from exile. So here's the scene. All the Israelites gather at Jerusalem. Ezra reads the book of the law from a wooden platform, much like I am doing at this very moment. He's standing in the middle of the city, and all of the people gather around and listen to Ezra read the book of the law of Moses all day. They stand there all day and listen. I've been speaking almost 30 minutes, and I'm sure most of us are already tired. They stood there all day and listened to Ezra read the book of the law. I'm not going to do that, by the way. We're wrapping up. And then the people weep because they feel the weight of their sin. Ezra and the priest explain the law to the people and emphasize how far their forefathers had fallen. And then chapter 9 contains a wonderful prayer of confession. It was likely offered by Ezra on behalf of the people. I wanted to read it. I knew I wouldn't have time. So that's your homework. Go and read the prayer of confession in Nehemiah chapter 9. It's wonderful because it traces the history of Israel from creation all the way to the exile. And it keys in on the faithfulness of God and the unfaithfulness of the people. And then after that confession, the people renew the covenant in chapter 10. And it's the first time they'd done that in a long time. And some specific items of concern are listed. And the people say this, or rather this is said of the people, that they commit to join with their brothers. This is Nehemiah 10:29. Join with their brothers, their nobles, and enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord, our Lord, and his rules and his statutes. Key verse in Nehemiah. Look what they're committing themselves to. So that's the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. Just one thing I wanted to note about the two men. I think one of the most intriguing parts of the two books are the main characters, Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra means help. The name means help. Nehemiah means comfort. So in the days following the exile, who did God send to lead his people? Help and comfort. Both are said to have the hand of the Lord upon them. God's providence was active in the lives of these two leaders. Ezra was of the high priestly tribe. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses. He set his heart to study the law, to do it, to teach it. And he was granted opportunity to do just that. Ezra was a man who could weep over other people's sin. After he discovered the people had intermarried, he's sitting there weeping. Not because he sinned, but because his brethren had sinned. He was so distressed over that. Nehemiah and Ezra have different personalities. Ezra was unassuming. Nehemiah was self-confident, forward, direct. And that contrast is especially seen between how they treated their own hair. When Ezra learned that the people of Israel had sinned in the intermarriage, he tore out his own hair, and Nehemiah tore out the hairs of the people who had sinned. So a real difference between how the two handle their hair. Ezra carried a religious commission. Nehemiah carried a civil one, though he was certainly religiously motivated all along the way. Nehemiah was a man of prayer. He's often noted for praying often, and these short little one-sentence prayers are wonderful. He's a man of faith and action. He says often, I trust that God is going to do this, but then he doesn't just sit there and wait for it to happen. He does something. Action with his faith. He's a man willing to admit his own sin, and he's a man that is extremely concerned with pleasing God. In fact, the last phrase of Nehemiah is, remember me, O God, for good. Nehemiah wanted to do good before his God. So the crucial questions, what are the keys to understanding the book? Ezra Nehemiah is often thought of as a second Exodus, a salvation of sorts. David quoted for us in the call to worship a section of Jeremiah, which refers to the deliverance and rescue and redemption that would come for the people who had been exiled. So it's very similar to what happened all the way back in the days of Moses. The people of Israel came out of captivity and were ushered into the promised land and given a new identity, given religious rites, and so forth. And so the leaders of Israel sought to give them a portion of that which had been lost. We've said in our Route 66 journey that Kings explains why the exile happened. The people did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Chronicles explains that the people have a future. Ezra Nehemiah begins to build the future for Israel. But notice how this is done, and this is very interesting. Ezra Nehemiah builds a future for the people by calling them to the past. Restoration of the Jewish religious system is a focus. Promoting holiness and separation, the very things that God told them they must do when they go into the promised land. And then there's the renewing of the covenant that God had made with his people at Mount Sinai. So the future would be forged by a return to the past, to the covenant and the relationship that God had established with his people. And there are several specifics. Faithfulness to the law of Moses is a primary concern of the leaders of the return. The law is mentioned often. They read it. Sense and understanding is given of it to the people. It was very important to the post-exilic leaders that everybody who was there understood the law of God, because they recognized that not understanding the law of God is what had gotten them there in the first place, and they did not want that to happen again. Other spiritual disciplines are prominent in the book, prayer and fasting. And these are seen especially among the leaders. You've got the extended prayers of confession and the short prayers of Nehemiah for guidance. Temple worship is a top priority. And if you want to understand Ezra and Nehemiah, you need to focus on that. Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Ezra, and Nehemiah all focus on temple worship. Now, why would they do that? Well, the kings had consistently set up high places for the people to worship the pagan gods. And the Israelites who returned to the promised land knew that they could not keep doing that. And in fact, after the restoration, it seems that the Israelites actually learned a lesson, because idolatry isn't so much a focus after the exile. It didn't go away. Some people still did worship at the high places, but it was significantly decreased. Worshiping in the temple and worshiping in the right way is seen in Ezra and Nehemiah. And that's especially seen in Ezra 2. If the Levites couldn't prove their ancestry, they were not allowed to serve in the temple. Only those who could prove that they were Levites were going to be allowed to serve in the temple and to administer worship. And then sacrifices are a top priority. One other key to understanding the book, and that is, or rather, two quick ones. Complete solidarity, unity, is a focus of Ezra and Nehemiah. The people are often gathered as one man. When the temple is finished, it's dedicated by the whole congregation. They celebrate the festivals together. The wall is built by everyone. Nehemiah calls for social justice. When the issue of intermarriage is addressed, they all gather together and they all see the divorce that takes place between those who had intermarried with pagans. And then after Ezra reads the law, the entire congregation confesses their sins. So before the exile and leading up to the exile, the people were divided. They were spread out. And even during the period of the kings, they warred against one another. The people knew when they returned that they had to be one or they would fall. And so unity is a big focus. And then finally on the keys, Zerubbabel is the messianic hint. All through the Old Testament history books, we see hints of the Messiah who would come. And isn't it interesting that Chronicles ends by showing us the king sitting at the king of Judah sitting at the Babylonian king's table eating. And then Ezra Nehemiah opens with the ancestor of the kings leading the people of Israel back to Judah. So Zerubbabel of the line of David is featured in Ezra and Nehemiah. In fact, David is mentioned several times. You see how so much comes back to that. David's line is preserved. Why is that important? Because that's the line of Jesus. What does this say about God and how he deals with people? It's absolutely amazing to see God's faithfulness to his covenant with his people. All throughout the Old Testament history, he's always keeping promises. He is blessing obedience, and he's cursing disobedience, always. And God is gracious. His good hand is said to be working throughout this entire book. God's providence is everywhere. He's working behind the scenes. He's working in the hearts of people. He's raising up leaders. There's not a single miracle in Ezra and Nehemiah. And yet, God's providence is seen all throughout, that God is working events. How can a Christian apply this book to life? Well, Ezra and Nehemiah's God is our God. We still serve a God who is faithful to promises and who is gracious, but who does not tolerate sin. We should be serious about sin, and we need to separate from it. We noted that the people of Israel were unified during this time. They were unified within themselves, and they were unified in their separation from sin and the other peoples of the land. And we need to be the same about that. And we need to focus on spiritual disciplines. And I think we can learn from the leadership qualities of Ezra and Nehemiah how to be a good leader of God's people. It starts by studying the law, doing it, teaching it, praying, fasting, thinking about God. We have to work on ourselves first and then others.